And I'd like to welcome everybody to House Resources. It's approximately 1:05 on March 28th. And we have present Representative Wilson, Representative Herron, Representative Dick, Representative Gardner, Representative Foster, Co-Chair Feige, Co-Chair Seaton. Time I'll remind everybody about their cell phones. And today we're going to be taking up three issues. The first is House Bill 185, that's exempt discharges from the use of munitions. House Bill 146, land transfers from the state and Alaska Railroad. And HB 106, coastal management program. This is the second hearing we've had on House Bill 185 and 146. And if it's the, unless the committee has further questions after the end of the day, I would anticipate having action on those bills. House Bill 106, we will be continuing discussions on. And so is there anything come before the committee at this time? Okay, seeing none, House Bill 185. Welcome, Representative Tammy Wilson. Would you identify yourself for the record? And are there any additions that you would like to, information you'd like to provide the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tammy Wilson, State Representative for District 11 North Pole. All of you should have in your packets received a letter from DEC, and it hopefully would answer the questions that you had had previously. But the key point in the letter is that the change that the military is requesting is under Section 7, which will retain the state's policy to exempt ranges from permitting requirements in areas that are not currently required to have a permit under the state's Clean Water Act. So this, they do still have to have a permit. They wouldn't have to go for a duplicate one through the state. So we're not allowing anybody to do anything. We want them to go in there, get a permit. They would still be required to do any kind of cleanup once they leave the ranges. This just makes it to where they only have to get one. And we have DEC online who could probably answer some of the questions about what waters are U.S. and which ones are state, if you'd like to go there in that process, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and just for clarification, the permit would be the general permit that deals with these areas instead of a specific permit for that particular range. Is that what our permits are?
We would like to defer to the attorney. That is my understanding, but let's make sure we get it right, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And are there questions for the committee for the sponsor? We do have the attorney online. Let's see. Did you want to go to Ms. Walter? Or do you want to...
Yeah, the drafter of the Mr. Chair, the drafter of the letter is who we have online, which would be Lynn. Yeah, would be Lynn Kant, and she would be able to answer any questions you have.
Okay, Lynn, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Thank you, Lynn. Would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record, and then the question is on. You've probably heard it, but on the duplication of permits or a general permit, whether the standards would be the same.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lynn Kent, and I'm the Director for Water Division at Department of Environmental Conservation. And the sponsor is correct that this bill would prevent any duplication of permitting. We would be issuing a permit under the APDES permit, which is the state version of the federal permitting program. But I should point out that none of the conditions or protectiveness of the permitting would change with this legislation. And just to clarify on your question about a general permit versus an individual permit, we don't have a general permit right now for munitions use. We may have one in the future, but in the meantime, we'll use the individual permitting tool for those facilities that do require a permit.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee for Lynn Kent, DEC? Seeing none, thank you for clarification. Do you have anybody else that needs to offer anything on the bill?
Mr. Chair, if you have any further questions, we do have the DMVA here for questions, but only if you require that.
Okay. Are there any questions? Seeing none, we did have public testimony, and we did close public testimony. However, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Is there anyone online that signed up? No. So, thank you. So, we have no further public testimony. We're under committee discussion. Is there any further committee discussion on this bill? Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House Bill 185.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, if I might just ask one question.
Representative Gardner.
Before we do that, reading the letter from, Lynn Kent. Committee subsequent to House Bill 185 would only require the state to issue a permit if it's required to do so under the Clean Water Act. It's a subtle but important change that will retain the state policy to exempt ranges from permitting requirements for munitions discharges to the land and for discharges to waters that aren't required to have a permit. But under passage of this bill, they still would have to have a permit, just not two permits.
Through the chair, correct.
Thank you. I'm ready.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Munoz.
Thank you. I move House Bill 185, Version B, with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note, please.
And clarification, what version was that?
Version B. Or, no, I'm sorry. Are we working
Mr.
on?
Chairman.
We're working on, I'm sorry, E. Right. Okay. I withdraw the previous motion and move version E, which is CS for House Bill 185 with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing no objections, CS for House Bill 185-27-LS-0506-E will move from committee with individual recommendations and attach zero fiscal note. And the paperwork will be coming around. Thank you, Representative Wilson, for bringing the bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now we'll go to House Bill 146, Land Transfers from State and Alaska Railroad. Well, Representative Tammy Wilson is before us again.
Thank you for the...
Would you identify yourself on the record, though, again?
Mr. Chair, and thank you so much. Again, I'm still Tammy Wilson, Representative District 11 North Pole. I didn't change. And to get this clear, the first time I'm going to let my staff tell you about this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Rick Vanderkalk, staff to Rep. Wilson. This is just a recap. It was introduced last week, and what has changed since the introduction is we have a couple more people available for testimony to answer questions. I believe Wendy Linskoog is available from the railroad, as well as Mr. Huppert, general counsel, and the champion constituent who's been pushing this for, alerting us for the last at least 3 years, I believe it's been Ms. Waltstead, and whose property is affected by this bill. And quick recap, in 03, Congress repealed the right-of-way reversion provision in the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act, and this bill just reinstates that mechanism whereby landowners can receive ownership of their property back once the easement is no longer in use. And that's it. So we have our cast available for questions.
Okay, thank you. And for the committee's information, we have Wynn Menifee, Division of Land, Land and Water, Bill Humprick of the Alaska Railroad, and Wendy Linskoog of the Alaska Railroad online for questions. Were there any outstanding questions that the committee had asked on this bill at the last meeting?
Mr. Chair, there was one. I believe there was one by Representative Herron that had to do with the military. And so I just kind of wanted to revisit this. This only happens if the railroad completely leaves the ground and every part of that happens. Does it go back? So the military no longer would be utilizing this property at that point.
Okay. Thank you. And since we have, do we have a sign-up sheet? One of the persons affected is here in Juneau, so I would like to offer an opportunity if she would like to testify. I don't have the sign-up sheet right now, but if you would come forward and identify yourself on the record, and if you wouldn't mind, since I spelling your name for me so I can get it in the record.
Certainly. Bonnie, B-O-N-N-E, Woolstead, W-O-L-D-S-T-A-D, North Pole, Alaska.
Thank you. And would you go ahead and give us a short background? We've been given background by the sponsor of the bill, but if you would care to add anything, that we would be happy to hear.
In a way, you can kind of look at this bill as being a little bit of housekeeping. It's basically just returning the rights that we had previous to the reversionary repeal that took place in 2003.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of the committee for Ms. Wilson? Seeing none, thank you for joining us. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on House Bill 146? Is there anyone else online that is signed up to testify or would like to testify? Okay, seeing none, we'll close public testimony and committee discussion. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess to the sponsor, is there any other railroad issues should we take care of while we're here? Land transfers?
Respectfully through the chair, no. and a follow-up to that, Representative Herron, in all seriousness, there's, as far as we know, this is the only area in the state that was homesteaded when this was done that would fall underneath this revisionary statute, and that is why it is very narrow title. Is as far as we have been made aware of, no other railroad lines would fall underneath this category.
Okay, thank you, Representative Herron. Are there any further questions? Desire of the committee? I believe, just a minute, I believe we've adopted the CS. Is that correct? We're on CS version M?
Yes. Mr. Chairman?
Is that correct? Yes. Representative Herron?
With the committee's approval, I move CS for House Bill 146. Version M from committee with individual recommendations and any fiscal notes.
And just for clarification, we have three fiscal notes and they're all zero fiscal notes. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 146, version M, that is 27LS0505/M. We'll move from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes, zero fiscal notes. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee. And I want to tell you how thrilled that I won't miss finance at all today. Thank you.
And we'll take a brief at ease while we're finishing up the paperwork. Okay, we'll come back on the record. We are now have House Bill 106 before us. We have amendments that were turned in and were distributed this weekend. And just to be clear, there are several that we're not going to take up today. There's still some questions and discussions about how to construct those and where they are. So amendment number A.13. Amendment number A.4 and amendment A.5 will be following up. We have just received some additional information concerning those the 28th just before we came in, and one of those was from DEC and the other was from DNR. And so those documents have just been distributed to the committee, and we want to make sure that the committee has time to look at those before we consider them. So,
Now, this is the one pager you're talking about.
Yes, and you have a package of amendments.
Right, but I mean the cover sheet is this one.
Yeah.
What does it look like?
Nine of them.
Yeah.
That's the cover sheet.
Which one?
Should look like this.
So you mentioned amendment A.13, but there's no 13 on it.
Is it the very bottom?
Or it says amendment forthcoming.
So
the one I...
That's A13.
That's A13.
Okay, so A13 is the number, the
well,
go down.
Yeah, you're the last one down there that establishes Coastal Policy and Appeals Board.
So could you go over the ones that are in are going to be held?
Sure. A.4 is adequately addressed standard.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be a new amendment coming. There's some wording revisions around that. There's A.5, which is deleting the DEC carve-out. And there is the one that's the Alaska Policy, Coastal Policy and Appeals Board, which was A.13, and there's a new amendment changing some wording coming on that.
So only three of this list?
Only three of this list, yes.
Okay.
That's the intention. And, yes, Madam Chair, or sorry about that. Do you have a copy of the, do you have another copy?
No. This is what you're looking for, Peggy?
Do you have the cover sheet, the bullet point?
Yeah, the cover sheet.
So this one, yeah, we'll wait on that one. Yeah. Brief at ease. The purpose of this is to get through those that we can, and if there are desires to hold some for further analysis or further thoughts, we can take and table those, but those that we can get dealt with would be helpful, because then we will have a smaller set of issues to deal with as we go forward in the process here. And we will be taking this up again, and hopefully any member that has additional amendments that we'll have those so that we can hear them on Wednesday. And there are some additional amendments. You know, we have one on reporting requirement, a report to the legislature. There may be additional amendments that members want, and that is fine. But if we can take care of these issues as we go forward, that would be helpful. So the first amendment we have, and just for everybody's information, just to get a procedure down, I went ahead and had all of these amendments drafted. It does not mean that I'm going to support every amendment, but you know, you'll see my name on these, and that is so that we could just get them on the table and deal with each one of these issues. The committee felt that instead of dealing with a large package, they wanted to deal with each individual amendment, and so the way to do that was to get them broken as amendments, and instead of trying to have individual members offer specific amendments, it was, that's why they're all just have my name on. So the first amendment we have is A.2, if everybody would find that one. And I think that everybody will remember that they have their also their spreadsheet that shows how many of the different districts and which of districts looked at each one of these subjects and commented on them that they wanted changes. And so I will offer A.2.
I'll object for discussion purposes.
Okay, thank you, Representative Wilson, for objecting. And this is one that was identified by almost every district, the designated areas. So this clarifies that the enforceable policies apply to all land and water issues subject in the plan, but you know, it requires them to be clear and concise, but it does not require that the area be designated. And we had a couple of presentations that were given to us before on designated areas, and that the 2008 draft amendments for ACMP federal elevation. Our evaluation had this in there, removing it. We have it in the legislative audit calling for designated areas to be removed, and we also had in the draft regulations that did not go forward, there was that. So are there questions on A.2? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could the department come up? I would like to ask some questions.
Sure. And do we have someone representing DNR here? Would you come up?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Randy Bates, Director of the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management.
Randy, what I would like you to do is say why you feel this was important to be there and what the ramifications will be if we take it out. And maybe there won't be any. And if not, just say so.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, so specific to A.2, when we're talking about designated areas, the concept behind designated areas was to draw in specific areas to manage that are important and that create some predictability for the industry. Those designated areas are captured within the regulations as they currently exist. And so you were asking why they're there, and that is that.
I mean, yeah. Can we get along without them?
Okay.
I don't know.
For the record, my name is Joe Balash, Deputy Commissioner to the Department of Natural Resources. I apologize to the committee for misjudging the timing of this particular set of issues. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this particular amendment as written is one that I think we have some remaining concerns, but on the question of whether or not you need to have a designated area in order to have an enforceable policy, there might be some ways to massage those particular linkages. The question or concern really becomes one of how to devise or develop that enforceable policy so that it's meaningful to applicants ahead of time, so that they can plan appropriately for their activities and projects to be able to survive the consistency review process and ultimately the permitting process. Designated areas allow applicants and stakeholders to understand what it is they're contending with and specifically where and when. And that really is the tension on this particular issue. Short answer, can we live with this separation of designated areas from enforceable policies in certain circumstances or under certain conditions? The answer is yes.
And what about the other uncertain circumstances?
That goes to the question of enforceable policies, which a lot, you know, this program is incredibly interconnected and interdependent. Different pieces of policy are intertwined with other sections of the statute. And so if you're going to disconnect enforceable policies from designated areas, then you have to be mindful of the way you allow enforceable policies to be developed and applied in the local plans. Again, it's a really big piece of the program because the local district then, during the review process, enjoys due deference in the interpretation and application of that local policy. And in order for the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management to understand whether or not that particular interpretation, that deference that's given, is correct, we need that policy to be very clear, very specific, and understand how to apply it in the context of a review in order to allow projects to move through the process.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
So you're not clear at all to me. So I guess what I'm hearing you say, or hearing you not say, is if there is a designated area beforehand, then afterwards there won't be so much squabbling about it.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the clearer the rules are, and the clearer it is.
That was a yes or no.
I'm sorry. please restate the question. I'm leaning towards yes, but I want to make sure I understand.
I'm just trying to read between the lines here because it's not real clear. So I'm guessing that if the designated if there's a designated area beforehand, then afterwards, when you go through the process, there's not as much squabbling.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, having designated areas makes the rules clearer, and so yes, it has less squabbling, there's less confusion in the application of enforceable policies, because either you're in a designated area where that policy applies or you're not. If the policy applies to the coastal district writ large, then you need to make sure that there's sufficient information in the plan to know, in the subsistence example, what subsistence activities or resources are present in the district, when, and where. And so that's what we're wrestling with.
Representative Wilson, follow up.
So then the other part that I'm trying to read in between the lines is the fact that you said that there was things that could be massaged to make it easier for people to live with, I guess. And so if that's correct, if that's what I thought I heard you say, in between the lines, that have you then tried to do the massaging, to get together with these people to work things out?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we received these specific amendments broken out from the CS yesterday. We've done some initial review of the language, it's difficult for me to provide a specific position without knowing how other amendments are drafted and ultimately how the pieces all fit together. If this were the only change being offered and that's all we were going to talk about the rest of the session, I could talk about this specific piece. But when we're talking about making changes to the authority of the Commissioner of Natural Resources, when we're talking about the parameters around enforceable policies and whether or not other agency standards are going to be included or excluded, it's difficult to say that this specific change in isolation is okay or not.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Representative Munoz Feige-Heron And before we go on, though, I wanted to clarify something. You said it's best to know what the program is ahead of time, and it's agreed, but didn't you testify at our last meeting that people can come in during the review process at the on your flow chart, the second line, that they can then put in comments, the districts can. So the industry is not going to be aware of those, and so we would be instituting something that is unknown, whereas if we have those policies as enforceable policies, then the industries are going to know what the parameters are to begin with, instead of having partway through the review a nomination by a coastal district to put that parameter into your flow chart at day 13-17.
Mr. Chairman, the opportunity to request designated areas in the review process is an opportunity just for the designation. It is when you request a designated area, designated subsistence area specifically, what the district then gets to do is enjoy deference on the application of the statewide standard on subsistence in that area.
Sure. So, your statement was that it's the industry needs to know the rules, and if they're in enforceable policies, they know the rules, and if they're added on as a designated area, nominated designated area in the review process, they haven't known the rules before. Isn't that okay?
Mr. Chairman, the having designated areas ahead of time and having enforceable policies ahead of time is the ideal.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Joe. Here in the Juneau area, we have an established game refuge with enforceable policies that relate to the game refuge. If we were to remove designated area requirements in the ACMP program, could it be that the policies that relate to that area would they apply to other areas outside of that established?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, I'm not 100% certain of the answer, but it does open the door. You would, as I understand the amendment, the local district would still be allowed to have a special management area with specific policies that apply within that area, but you wouldn't necessarily have to have a special management area or a designated area in order to apply the policy. You could just have the blanket management policy in the district. And that's where, again, the tension is on the scope of enforceable policies versus the requirement to have a designated area.
And thank you. And Representative Munoz, I just point to lines 21 and 22 on page 1 of the amendment, A.2. As the answer, I think, to your question, they can have policies that apply only to special management areas. So, we have Representative Faggy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Why has it been so difficult for coastal management areas to come up with, or coastal management districts, to come up with designated areas? It seems that it's, if you have to support, you have to have a basis for your enforceable policy, and you need to come up with scientific or local knowledge to back up that enforceable policy. Would it make more sense to confine that to a defined area? Not only so applicants down the road would know where that enforceable policy would apply, but also so DCOM can look at it and determine if there's enough science or enough local knowledge being contributed to justify having a designated area.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, a couple of answers to that I think will help fill out the picture. The first is, I think the legislative audit that was conducted recognized that 70% of requested designated areas were approved. The hurdle to get a designated area is lower than the hurdle to get a local enforceable policy. You can have a designated area without a local enforceable policy, but you can't have a local enforceable policy without the corresponding area. And so that is part of the issue at play. And there seems to be consternation, frustration with the failure to approve enforceable policies without a recognition that the approval of designated areas goes a long way in setting up the coastal district's seat at the table in the review process.
Follow up, Representative Feige.
So if we get rid of designated areas, that means the enforceable policies then would apply to the entire coastal zone district?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, I think the specific language that the chair had just referenced on page 1 of the amendment, lines 20 through 22, the plan would include a statement of policies to those policies that apply to all land and water uses, as well as policies that apply only to special management areas. So there would be sort of a two-tier effect on policies. Some would apply throughout the district. Some would apply in a more narrow sense to special areas.
Mr. Chairman, for my clarification.
Follow-up, Representative Feige.
What is the difference between a special management area and a designated area? Is that defined anywhere? Seems like you're trying to accomplish the same thing.
One thing is that the federal government has said that designated areas cannot be applied to federal lands, so that we lose the ability, as stated on page 29 in the audit of the first volume one of the audit there. So requiring area designation to be able to apply certain statewide standard potentially reduces the purview of consistency reviews, difficulty in establishing designated areas as previously discussed may result in the inability to fully evaluate the impact of activities in the OCS or on federal lands to subsistence uses and important habitats in the coastal zone. So that is the problem. We have limited the ability to comment. Well, not to comment. We can always comment, but to have effect on federal lands by requiring these designated areas. Special management areas can be adopted. We've had communication from in the reports from the feds that designated areas can't include the federal lands, and those have been turned down for that reason. So that's all I can tell you on that.
So federal lands would include special management areas? How exactly are the special management areas defined? You're talking game refuges and that kind of thing?
They could be, Representative Feige, a number of different ways. Also, you could have migratory route of caribou. If you were along a coastal plain, you wouldn't have to designate each specific spot. Like was testified by the commissions, if you're talking about seals aren't in one spot all the time. You can talk about habitat types, and you can designate those, you know, of special concern. So that's where we are. If you want further information, we can get it. Just a moment. I think that the department would like to weigh in on this one.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make sure that the understanding here is clear, because I think this actually goes back to one of the misunderstandings caused by a difference of agreement on policy. There seems to be a suggestion here that by going back to the language that was used pre-2003 for special management areas, that somehow that's going to allow us to designate federal lands, and that's not the case. Special managed by changing the name doesn't mean that you can now include federal lands and federal areas in these special management areas. That's not correct. The program prior to 2003 was doing that, but it was an oversight in the prior federal approvals that nobody caught. And I think that the audit report notes that. It doesn't matter if you call it a special management area or a designated area. You can't include federal lands.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Balash, this cover sheet of these amendments, hopefully we'll get through the six remaining that were not held. So just so I understand, the department will work with us on each of these amendments, and if there is something that we can work out on each amendment, we may disagree on it, but we can come to terms, or is the department going to dismiss these out of hand?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I apologize for, again, missing the beginning section, so I don't know if all of the amendments on the sheet here.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Herron.
Is Mr. Balash, A4, A5, and A13 are being held by direction of the co-chairs.
Okay.
But again, Mr. Chairman, are you willing to work with us on the remaining amendments, or are you going to dismiss them out of hand?
Well, if you would like just a quick inventory or assessment, I can tell you very clearly which ones the administration is opposed to, and if that's helpful.
I would defer to my co-chair.
Sure. It's fine with me. They'll be offered. We're just going right down and offering them in line, but if you,
Mr. Chairman,
this time,
obviously it's your show, but one at a time is fine with me.
I would just hate to get us all balled up talking about other amendments and why they would be when those aren't on the table.
Yeah.
We have one on the table if we want to withdraw.
No, Mr. Chairman, I agree. So Mr. Balash can. We'll just keep the discussion on amendment number two.
Representative Herron.
Two general questions is, why are designated areas required in regulation but not required in federal law and state statutes?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, my understanding is that the specific statutes that spell out where enforceable policies shall be provided, I believe is in 040 and 070. I would have to call on my technical resource here, Mr. Bates, to more fully answer your question.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
I'd like to use that question to frame it. So, given the response that I thought I heard you say earlier to Representative Wilson, could we, at least for my questions, could we just talk about subsistence, designated subsistence use areas? And then the other areas, maybe other committee members could talk about. So could we have an amendment that repeals subsistence dedicated areas for the moment and leave the other dedicated areas alone? Would you support that?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, the issue surrounding subsistence areas is going to go directly to the level of information provided in the plan regarding the nature of those activities, the location, and the timing throughout the year. At the statewide standard level, the policy is that applications from project sponsors are to avoid subsistence areas if that's not practicable, to minimize any impact or effect on subsistence activities, and if that's not possible, to then mitigate the impacts on those subsistence activities. And the ability of a project sponsor to accomplish that is dependent upon the information they have at hand when they look to the local plan to plan their project. And so being as candid as I can at the moment, you know, I think there are some ways to get there. I don't have them written out specifically, but it is something that I think we could work through.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Herron.
Same topic. So can you explain to me and to the committee is how do you work through the conundrum then? So you require a district to have designated subsistence areas, and they do their best, they do their due diligence, but yet when they're later, you know, 10 years from now, if the subsistence areas are too large, you deny them. If they're not specific enough, you may approve them, but what happens when there is a project that has an effect on a subsistence species or whatever, you say, well, you didn't designate it, so tough luck. So how do you justify that conundrum?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, it's an ongoing struggle, but the plans themselves are not set in stone and left there forever. They can be amended from time to time as information is gathered or made available to supplement or augment the local coastal plan, and that's a big part of the program staying in tune over time is the ability of districts to be able to amend those plans and include additional information. And that, I think, is where a regular opportunity for districts to understand the ability to change those plans is going to be important. That's why the training that DCOM provides to the districts is important. It's important to maintain is so that they can continue to understand what the program is, how it can be made to work, and what the opportunities are to change the plan so that it better suits the needs of the local communities. And that's not to say that you have to necessarily specifically draw very tight lines and say you only have to worry about subsistence activities right here, but trying to find the balance that makes the consistency review process predictable is where there needs to be a program staff that can help both at the review stage as well as in the planning stage, and that really is incumbent upon DCOM to execute. And so at risk of straying off onto potentially other amendments, the ability of the commissioner to make the final decisions here is incredibly important, because somebody has to balance those things out and be able to react to the needs of the districts as well as the needs of industry.
And I think that we don't want to stray too far afield, because what we wanted to do is we wanted to put these as amendments on particular policy issues to look at. You know, the policy issues that were brought to us, we've seen the changing standards that were required for getting a subsistence designated area, the maps at one level, and then later on the maps at a much more refined level. And so the problem is that this is addressing is what, you know, 10 of the districts addressed, is that these changing requirements, they could never get their designated areas really refined because the goals were changing. And since we under subsistence, where we're talking about a designated area, it did become much more problematic. This amendment has it so that there can still be special management areas, whether it's outside federal areas or whichever, but at least those can be designated. But for those areas, like for seals that are important along a coastline, you can designate that in a broader sense than you would if you said it has to be in this particular cove, and the problem was at what particular level of refinement those designated areas were. So that's why it's been such a huge problem for all the districts, and that's why it's been one of the most heavily commented on things that we had. So,
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Harris.
One follow-up question to Mr. Balash, and then I'll get out of the way and then maybe reserve the rest of my questions for later. But Mr. Balash, in your response, and I appreciate your response, is that as the way I heard you and the way I think I understand you, is that that's where we come to another conundrum. You indicated that they have this ability to change their plan, but isn't that where the criticism comes from my friends in mining, that, oh, well, that's a delay. Well, blame those district people, because now they want to change their plan, so my project is delayed. So I guess, Mr. Balash, why should we have yet another conundrum? Because, oh, you can change your plans, but until you change your plans, you're not going to be able to comment on a subsistence issue being affected. I mean, I'm disappointed, and I don't understand.
Is that a statement or a request?
I asked him, why do we have to have yet another conundrum? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Herron, the rules in place at any given time will be the rules used to evaluate a given project at that moment. Over time, as plans change, new projects will come along, and they might be held to a different set of rules or a different set of standards as those plans change. But one thing that I do want to emphasize is local districts can comment on subsistence uses and activities even if they don't have a specifically designated area. Mm-hmm. What what seems to be lost in the discussion here is that the that certain districts would like to make sure that they're only commenting if they're going to be afforded due deference. And that's where the question of whether there's a local policy or not comes into play. The reviewing district, the affected district, can comment on subsistence activities even if they don't have a local subsistence policy, even if they don't have a designated area. And those comments do get taken into consideration by the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management in the review process. It's just that some people insist on only playing with loaded dice.
And before we go further, I want to clarify, because I don't want to, it seems like we're narrowing this down to pointing fingers at a couple of districts. And just so everybody understands, the comments that were, this was specifically requested as a problem by the Aleutians East Borough, the Bristol Bay Borough, the Kenai Peninsula Borough, the City of Nome, the North Slope Borough, Northwest Arctic Borough, the City of Pelican, the City and Borough of Sitka, City of Whittier, and the City and Borough of Yakutat. So I want to make sure that we're not pointing to one or two boroughs and saying that those are the only people that identified this specifically as a problem, or talking about certain districts as if they are a problem, because it's identified by a large number of districts. Representative Wilson.
Well, first of all, I want to make a comment that that when people testified, they were commenting for each other sometimes. And so just because there's 10 on the list doesn't mean that 10 had that same problem. But other than that, I'm very, very concerned about this amendment. And the reason I'm concerned is because I don't have it figured out in my head, and so I'm just assuming that maybe there's some other people that don't have it figured out either. But I'm concerned about people, about getting rid of these designated areas, because I think the designated areas help them, help the groups that, and I could be wrong here, but I think that if they have the designated areas set out ahead of time, it helps them when they go into a review process. And so I'm a little worried about trying to get rid of them, because I think maybe because it's so complicated that we may be getting rid of something that's not the best thing to get rid of. So for that reason, let me use an example so that you can tell me if I'm right or wrong on this. If a district or a borough or whoever has some designated areas, whether it's subsistence, whether it's habitat, whatever, but they have those. Then if some business comes in and wants to do something, put up a dam or something, they can say, now wait a minute, our designated areas and our policies say this. And so that person has to work around those policies or try to come up with something that they can come together on, to work something out that everybody can agree on. Or if it's in an area that they hadn't thought of before, they can say, wait a minute, we want to, the borough can say, you know, we hadn't thought of that before, but there is a fish run right up there by that dam that we're concerned about, and they can put that in there. If there's no designated areas and the same thing happens, then there's nothing, nowhere to start from. You just have to start from scratch, and that really would take a long, long time for everybody. And so having these things takes quite a while and a lot of work to do them ahead of time, but it kind of makes you think ahead and establish areas. And if you think ahead and establish the areas, it kind of protects you when somebody comes in all at once and wants to do something and you've only got 30 days to do it. Am I wrong when I say that?
No. But through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't think there's any question that having designated areas helps everybody understand the rules more clearly and be able to operate more efficiently through the review process. As I understand the amendment, designated areas or special management areas, whichever you want to call them, don't go away. They can still be present, and they, I can tell you, would be encouraged by the department in the plan development process. And that's something that we would need to emphasize repeatedly and clearly in the training that is then done for districts.
So just...
I know they don't go away.
Well, just to clarify...
Just if they didn't happen, what would happen?
To clarify, the difference is that right now you have to have a designated area. You can't have a policy that covers more than the designated
area. That's what I'm saying.
And that's what you... Yeah, but the problem is if you...
If you don't have them... What are you going to do when you only have 30 days to get this figured out?
If industry is not aware that the caribou or the seal that are along the North Coast are an enforceable policy and they have to regard those outside of a desert, other than in one small cove that they've got a designated area for.
That's what I mean. Why should we get rid of them?
Because a designated area in one small cove does not cover where the subsistence harvest is.
Well, there can be more than one.
There haven't been very many approved.
I think this
Representative Feige and then Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of two questions. Is there a size limit on a designated area?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, no.
Okay, so this thing is as big as the coastal zone wants it to be.
He has a response, I believe, on that.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, you need to be able to show that the activity or the habitat or the natural hazard is present in the area. So while it's true it can be big, you would have to show that the subsistence activity is occurring throughout the entire area, and so that is a... there's what's possible, but then in the application of the requirements for a designated area, more often than not, it gets to be a more limited geographic area.
Okay. Representative Feige?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The second part of my question is, for this entire process, to me, I look at it as a checklist for an applicant to obtain a consistency review. That checklist is all the different federal, state, local statutes and enforceable policies that apply. But somebody has to write the checklist first. So to define what all those rules are, the coastal zones need to come up with a plan. And if they do, they get... the preference on considerations when it comes to reviewing this plan. So if we take away the, and assuming they can still have designated requirements, so if they didn't have a designated area, then they simply would not get preference in that particular area if during the review process the issue came up, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, that's correct. The question of the circumstances when a district enjoys due deference in the review process goes to whether or not they have a local enforceable policy or a designated area. And where that becomes important is after you've come through the comment deadline where all of the reviewing entities have submitted their comments, they look for consensus among the groups, all of the reviewing entities, state, federal, local. And if they can't find consensus, then DCOM has to start looking to, you know, deciding whose comments are going to drive the decision. And that's where deference becomes important and relevant.
Representative Feige.
The rules for establishing a designated area, basically the local knowledge, the supporting evidence, is there any way that we can make, that we can lower the bar anymore to allow, to make it easier for areas to encompass more more land area into a designated area? In my view, the bar is based on the conversations from the last meeting, where basically somebody can say, yes, I hunt caribou in this area here. The bar doesn't seem to be particularly high.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, I think the districts would disagree with that statement, and the division would probably agree with that statement, and that's where we obviously have tension. If we were to somehow lower the hurdle for granting an area, then the question still is going to arise, how is a local policy developed and approved and then ultimately applied in the review process? And so increasing the number or size of designated areas might go some way to scratching the itch for local districts, but it might not get as far as they would like.
Okay. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Are there districts that have policies that apply to the entire area or entire district?
I'd like to check on that, Mr. Chairman.
For the record, Randy Bates, through the chair, Representative Munoz. Over the course of the past 6 or 7 years, we have processed probably only a dozen designated areas within the context of a consistency review. And what that means is once we initiate a project review, we've only received about 12 or 14 requests to designate for that project specifically. I do believe that there have been at least 4 or 5, maybe 6, that have been at the request of the North Slope Borough. Within those designated areas, they have requested the entirety of the coastal zone, specific to permafrost for natural hazards. They've asked for specific areas around the communities where they hunt bowhead whales, and other. So, yes. We ask, for the most part, the districts have been refined in their requests in terms of where they ask to designate, and we have similarly approved those focused areas. But there are certain requests, like natural hazards for permafrost or ice scour, that have been throughout the entire coastal zone. And then we're talking about the North Slope Borough here, which is quite an expansive area. Does that answer your question, or are you specific?
So just to follow up for clarification, so there's 16 areas that are 16 policies that
were promulgated with designated areas. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, 16 policies. Is that from the audit or where?
You just mentioned 16. Were that policy? Were they policies or designated areas?
Okay. Help me help you understand. So if what I said was there were a dozen or so designated area requests that we've handled through the consistency review process, is that what I said? Is that what you're referring
okay.
to?
Okay.
Excuse so me. There's two cons. Sorry.
Can I
answer one more?
You used the number 16, I believe. I heard 16, but that's fine. Okay. My question was, are there policies that apply to the entire district? Are there examples of that in the current program?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz. Off the top of my head, I don't believe there are approved policies throughout the entire district specific to subsistence when we're talking about an area as big as the North Slope or the Northwest. I know that we did engage during mediation on those policies, and we came much closer to an approvable plan, and we came to agreement on approvable areas for those two districts. But those are the two that were had the most requested areas and the biggest areas. I do believe that there are probably I would be happy to look into it. Right off the top of my head, I can't answer your question in terms of whether there is a district with an entire coastal zone designation for subsistence. I'd be happy to find out for you.
Okay.
Yeah. Follow-up, Representative Munoz.
I'm also interested in other policies. Mm-hmm. Subsistence is very important. I'd also like to know, in addition to that, policies that are non-subsistence oriented
okay.
that might apply to the entire district.
Certainly. Through the chair, Representative Munoz, there are four. As a simple refresher, there's two opportunities to designate. One is within the planning process of a coastal district, and the other is within the consistency review process of a specific project. Within the context of a district planning process, there's a number of items that they can designate for or on and then write enforceable policies, and that includes tourism, recreation, energy siting, commercial seafood and fish processing, natural hazards, habitat, subsistence, archaeology, and prehistory. There's a number of items that they can designate on during their planning process, and again, the beauty of that is we gather information, it's there, and retrievable when an applicant comes in and wants to know, are they going to impact an area where they're going to locate their project. Within the state standards, then, a district can, through the consistency review process, designate four areas: habitat, subsistence, natural hazards, and archaeology. Okay. There are, if I could just finish on that, there are districts that have, for any number of those topics, they do have district-wide designations for either tourism, recreation, or something else.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. We have further comments, further committee discussion. So we have amendment number two before us. And that is to remove the requirement for a designated area before you can have a subsistence or habitat, natural hazard, or archaeological site usage in the district. And this amendment would remove that requirement that you had to designate that specific site. So any further questions? Okay, we have an objection. Representative Wilson, you objected?
Yes.
Okay, Madam Chair, could you call the roll? No discussion? Oh, wait a minute. That's what I was asked. we were in under committee discussion. Is there further committee discussion on the amendment? Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to the whole, in my view of the world, a checklist and then executing the checklist, it's important to have a clear, concise, and well-defined checklist. The big objective of the coastal management program, in my view, is to put the rules out there for an applicant so that right from the start, the applicant knows what the rules are. And by having a designated area, you do specify where a particular area that an enforceable policy or a rule would apply. And to not put that requirement in the ACMP, in my mind, on the backside of the process, opens it up to all kinds of, questioning. Okay, what is the rule, and why does it apply here in a particular area? If it's difficult to come up with the basis for why, take the case of subsistence. If it's hard to come up with the case for saying that you do a particular subsistence activity in a defined area called a designated area, and how is the coastal zone district going to come up with enough data and local knowledge and whatever references they want to use to back up their enforceable policy to enforce over the entire coastal zone district? It certainly will behoove the coastal zone districts to define those areas, because when they do define those areas, they designate those areas, and then they are getting a preference in terms of their priority in the decision-making process. I think perhaps instead of removing the designated area requirement, we should figure out a way to make it easier for coastal zone districts to define those designated areas. And we should work with the DCOM to amend their regulations, as long as it's – so I do not favor this amendment.
Okay. Further discussion? In wrap-up, then, I'd just like to say that I agree with you that a checklist is good to have up front. The problem is we have a back-end checklist where during the review process, people can designate 13 days into the process, can designate an area for nominate an area is designated instead of doing it up front, and so that the industries that have a project are not well aware because we have made the restrictions so tight on designated areas and for subsistence or habitat that industry isn't aware of what are the big issues because they aren't in enforceable policies. That's the reason for the enforceable policies, by having this very large constraint on designated areas. Then what we've done is we've made industry not knowing that, whether it's seal along the coast or whether it's caribou, whether certain migration places where caribou are at the time, and it may change over time. So if industry doesn't know that ahead of time through an enforceable policy that where these animals are going to occur in as your project goes forward, you're going to need to make sure that you design your project so that it doesn't negatively impact those uses or those resources. And that's the purpose for those, where we have almost every subsistence designated area has been denied by DCOM. And I agree with you that we wouldn't be having this problem, that the enforceable policies, the big list of them that we have before us, of the 210 that were approved out of the 490 that were proposed by districts, we have a number of them that aren't, for a number of reasons, but that's our problem. And so if the department, after if we adopt this amendment and the department comes in and wants to talk with the committee and devise some alternative mechanisms that they think will work better, you know, that would be welcome. I think that would be welcome by all to have that discussion. But at this point in time, in wrap-up, that's the purpose of this amendment, is to allow special management areas, which are designated areas, and but not to require them for the designation. So, Madam Chair, would you call the roll?
Okay, Amendment A.2. Representative Kawasaki?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
No.
Representative Heron?
Yes.
Representative Munoz?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Dick?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
Yes.
Co-Chair Feige?
No.
Co-Chair Seaton?
Yes.
7 yeas, 2 nays.
So by a vote of 7-2, amendment number A.2 has been adopted. We now have amendment A.6 before us. And A.6 exempts projects requiring an EIS from the 90-day consistency review limit. And we'll take just a moment at ease while people get A.6 performed. we are looking at amendment number 2, which is A.6. And A.6, again, it exempts projects that require an environmental impact statement from the 90-day consistency review time limit. The purpose for this amendment is EISs are long duration activities, and if we have a complicated project that requires an EIS, having the consistency review requirement of a 90-day approval for that that project is just inconsistent. So I would move amendment number 2 if I didn't already, and Representative Wilson.
Object for discussion.
Object for discussion. Discussion. Representative Wilson.
I'd like the department up here and explain why there's 90 days, I guess. And if it does that always take a lot longer?
Thank you. For the record, again, my name is Joe Balash, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, we have within the current statute a specific limitation on how long consistency reviews can take in order to make the process predictable. This particular amendment violates one of the four principles that we identified early on regarding our willingness to engage constructively with the legislature on these questions of substance. I'm not aware of a problem that's being solved here. As a matter of fact, having consistency reviews conducted and performed early on in better informs project sponsors what it's going to take to meet the needs of the local coastal districts by getting a consistency determination early so that they can better adjust the project early on rather than at the back end after the EIS is close to having been completed.
And I'd just like to clarify that this didn't mean that it wouldn't be a consistency review. It just meant that the time limitations of the section don't apply if the project requires an EIS. So just wanted to clarify that statement of mine. Representative Wilson.
But wasn't that the reason that we
The whole thing was started because so that we could shorten the time it takes to get permits. So isn't the 90 days, that's part of the whole process, the reason that we wanted to get it into a time frame so that it wouldn't take 2 and 3 years to do something.
Representative Wilson, the requirement for an EIS, federal requirement, is not going to be circumvented by us saying we've got to approve permits in 90 days. An EIS will still be required for significant projects. And so the question is, do we want to have deadlines that run into each other and all of a sudden we're out of compliance with being able to do a project and make a consistency review within 90 days if it takes an EIS? And so that's what this is dealing with. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't recall any testimony that this has been a problem historically. Did I miss that? Have I forgotten it?
It wasn't any.
Representative Gardner, yes, there was testimony that the time limits were a problem. There were time limits on air quality permits. There were time limits where there was conflicting federal and state time limits on this. So that was what this was in response to. And this was a mechanism to look at long-duration projects that were complicated projects and how not to have that conflict. And this was a mechanism for getting at that, because all of those projects generally will require an EIS. And so how to identify those complex projects that are going to have that longer time frame is, it was thought that this would get to that problem. Representative Feige.
Because I remember talking about time frames, talking about DEC permits and the DEC carve-out. I don't remember. Environmental impact statement, and correct me if I'm wrong, Deputy Commissioner, is a federal requirement, correct?
With the Chair, Representative Feige, that's correct.
ACMP is a state program. Does the ACMP, do you have to have a consistency review or a determining of consistency before you start the EIS process?
Through the Chair, Representative Feige, not before you start the EIS process. You can start the clock on your consistency review once your application is complete, which you can complete the consistency review prior to the completion of the EIS process, and perhaps even in some cases before you get through even the initial comment phase on your EIS process. So having the consistency review occur at the front end of the EIS process actually goes some distance in sorting out a lot of the issues ahead of the final decisions being made by federal agencies in that EIS process. So we think having that time limitation in place and having it apply once the application is complete, once all the information is there, is something that's beneficial to the project and also is beneficial to the reviewing entities, both federal and local, because you can't get your other permits if your activity is taking place in the coastal zone and you don't have a consistency determination. So getting that determination early is beneficial. And again, what the division does in that review process is either finds that the project is consistent or that it is not consistent unless alternative measures are adopted. And that informs the project sponsor early on what they need to change to be consistent. And that helps on the front end rather than running into that solution at the back end and having to redesign or otherwise reorder materials or projects or components that are necessary for the project to be executed.
Representative Feige.
So in essence, the ACMP process guides an applicant and makes sure that applicant is pointed down a road that will achieve, that is most likely to achieve success, instead of having that applicant go off on a side track that perhaps turns into a dead end.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, I think that's a fair description. A consistency determination does not guarantee that you will actually get your other permits, but you can't get them without it.
Follow up.
And as far as the environmental impact statement, that's generally a fairly costly endeavor on the part of an applicant, correct?
Through the chair, I've never had to pay for one, but my understanding is yes.
So for the fairness to the applicant, it would be better to have that SEMP determination received sooner rather than later, so that there is no sidetrack, so they don't have to back up, spending money the whole time on the EIS process.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, I would agree with that sentiment. Precisely when they start that process is dependent upon when they show up with a complete application. A project sponsor could choose to do that at the earliest possible date, and I think as regulators, we would suggest that's a wise course for them to pursue.
Well, I just want to make sure that I get the statement really clear that the administration doesn't want to be able to stop the clock during the consistency review process for a very complex project that takes an environmental impact statement. If you're comfortable requiring the 90-day clock on a consistency review, even if it's a complex process that requires an EIS, I'm perfectly happy to withdraw this amendment. So if that's the admit, would you just make that a statement on the record that you would like to have the 90-day clock be firm for projects and not have the opportunity for stopping the clock if it requires an EIS?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to do that. The administration is adamant that the 90-day clock be preserved, that we do not want to have exceptions created that can spin that process out.
Good. We have progressed. I will withdraw amendment number 2, which was A.6. Now we have A.8 before us. And A.8 is a repealer that repeals the limitation that does not allow third-party review, third-party litigation based on coastal zone reviews. And I'll offer this as amendment number 3.
Object.
Thank you. And Representative Herron has objected. And this is being offered because so often when we talk to either industry agencies, the first question is, oh, changes are to go back to allow third-party lawsuits. And, you know, that's not my intention, and I offered this because I don't think it's the intention of the committee, but it will allow the committee to be on record that there is no intention in this, the amendments that we're putting forward that allow third-party lawsuits, and so that everybody will know up front that that's the case. And just so everybody's understanding what third-party lawsuits are, if a district is there at the table, they're a party, but a third-party lawsuit would be either an environmental or a industry group or party that is not associated with that project that wants to sue on the basis of the determination. And so this currently, pre-2003, third-party lawsuits were allowed. In 2003, the third-party lawsuits were no longer allowed, and this amendment says that we would allow third-party lawsuits. And just so it's clear, I'm intending to vote against this, just so that everyone knows that we are not trying to institute third-party lawsuits through any amendments that we're going forward here. Representative Wilson.
So you've put this amendment out that is going to start allowing third-party litigation, but you don't want it to pass so that everybody knows that we don't want third-party litigation.
Representative Wilson, that's exactly correct. That the first thing that comes up in every conversation is third-party lawsuits. Every time any change is being made to coastal zone, it's like, oh, you're trying to instigate third-party lawsuits again. This makes it clear, if the committee votes this down, that there is no intention in any of the amendments we're putting forward that will allow third-party lawsuits. It will leave the law exactly as it is right now as regards to third-party lawsuits.
Okay.
The reason for this is that we have legislative history, and our legislative history on this is going to be that we do not support third-party lawsuits. Maybe. It'll be up for a vote. So.
Call for the question.
Okay, I see no further discussion. Would you call for the question?
Okay, so this would be Amendment 3, labeled A.8. Representative Gardner.
May I pass? I'm just reading the statute in order.
Representative Kawasaki?
No.
Representative Wilson?
No.
Representative Heron?
No.
Representative Munoz?
No.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Dick?
No.
Co-Chair Feige?
No.
Co-Chair Seaton?
No.
Representative Gardner, are you ready?
I am. Thank you. No.
Okay. Zero yay, eight nay.
With a vote of zero.
Nine.
Zero in favor and nine opposed, amendment number 3A.8 fails to pass this committee. We also have an amendment A.9, which is our next one. And I will offer this as amendment number 4.
Object.
And thank you, Representative Heron, objected. The purpose of this is to allow the coastal zone to go inland and to any activity that would cause direct or significant impact to the coastal zone or use of a resource. This was previously to 2003, would allow coastal zone to go far up rivers, all the way to Fairbanks. This is a generally called the inland reach provision. This is the second question that's always brought up when we're talking about coastal zone amendments. And for the same purpose as the last amendment, this one is being offered. And I am going to be opposing it because we are, hopefully the committee will confine the coastal zone management plan to the coastal zone area. Is there further discussion? I also will, like I said, be not supporting this amendment. And I hope that what we are doing is putting the committee on record in the legislative history that we are not extending this coastal zone. So, Madam Secretary, would you call the roll?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask you a question before we call the roll, and that is, what would the impact have on potential efforts to fight the pebble mine to protect fisheries resources?
The if this would go through and you could go to the headwaters, I'm not sure how far up to the headwaters of a river past lakes would go, because of course that prospect has river drainages that go into a lake and then through a lake and then down another river system. You would have to see direct cause and significant impact of the coastal use or resource. I don't think that that would apply. I think going through the through a lake would be difficult to make that that jump. But I can't tell you for sure. That would be something for lawyers to probably litigate on.
Thank you. Third
party. Madam Secretary, would you call the roll?
Okay, Amendment 4, also known as A.9. Representative Dick?
No.
Representative Gardner?
No.
Representative Kawasaki?
No.
Representative Wilson?
No.
Representative Heron?
No.
Representative Munoz?
No.
Representative Foster?
No.
Co-Chair Feige?
No.
Co-Chair Seaton?
No.
Zero yay, and I got this time 9 nay.
Thank you. And so with a vote of 0 in favor and 9 opposed, Amendment number 4 fails to pass the committee. We now have an amendment number A.10, and that will be amendment number 5. And I'll move A.10 is amendment number 5. We have an objection by Representative Feige. And A.10 simply is a clarification that the project also includes the oil and gas leases. There was some question as to whether oil and gas leases were covered. In the current language of the bill, the information we have is that they are covered. We want to have everyone fully on notice that those are covered under this. Doesn't change the status of the law, doesn't change the status of the coverage. It just clarifies what is covered by the coastal zone management system. Further discussion? Representative Feige and then Representative Gardner.
I guess I don't recall any testimony where this was showed up as a point of contention. I'm sort of interested to hear what the impact of having ACMP cover oil and gas lease sales within the coastal zone, because that includes onshore as well as offshore. Correct?
That's correct. And the information that we had was that they are already covered. It's just not specified that activity, development activity, is covered. And so what this is doing is clarifying that what it's currently applied to is covered under the program.
Mr. Chairman, I think we should hear from the department as to pluses and minuses of whether or not we should be covering oil and gas lease sales into the coastal management process.
Welcome. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you. Again, for the record, my name is Joe Balash, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources. I'd like to call the committee's attention to some language here on lines 8 and 9. Project means all activities described and all activities in the lists of permits, certifications, leases, approvals, and authorizations. The concern that I have here is that I would like to look at this more closely, but if I need to give you an answer right now, the answer is the concern is that this may be doing some damage to the phasing that we presently employ in the reviews that are done in our oil and gas sale, exploration, and development processes. And my concern is that this is going to require the review to look beyond just the sale, but forward to anticipate whatever activities might occur through exploration and development. And so if that is the case, then we have severe concerns with this particular language.
And I appreciate that, and it's getting late in the day, and we need to give you time to actually review those and see if that is a same extension, same thing that's being applied to now, and in the same manner. That's what this is offered for. If there are conflicts with that, we want to know them. So with the committee's indulgence, what I'd like to do is withdraw this at this time, and I'll reoffer it when we have conversations and find out if there's an unintended scope to this amendment. So number five will be withdrawn at this time. And we have, I don't know if we have time. This is your, yeah. I think what we'll do is we will put the remaining amendments aside, and we will take this up on Wednesday. And as the committee goes through, make sure you look if you have further amendments that you wish to adopt or propose, get them to us. Hopefully you can get them to us the day before, especially if they're complex. If they're being drafted and you don't have them, if you could send us a outline of what the amendment is as a conceptual amendment, so at least everyone will be aware of what those are. Thank you, the committee, for today, and we will adjourn till 1 o'clock on Wednesday.